Hey, I'm Ryan Reynolds.
Recently, I asked Mint Mobile's legal team if big wireless companies are allowed to raise prices due to inflation. They said yes. And then when I asked if raising prices technically violates those onerous two-year contracts, they said, what the f*** are you talking about, you insane Hollywood ass f-. So to recap, we're cutting the price of Mint Unlimited from $30 a month to just $15 a month.
Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month. Slows full terms at mintmobile.com.
Hello, everybody, and welcome to Dane Baptiste Questions Everything, a podcast where myself, comedian, writer, and occasional actor Dane Baptiste, and my producer friend, Howard Cohen, a.k.a. The Hizzer.
Hello.
And a mix of very special guests pose the questions that need to be asked. And we are talking everything from...
How do you clean your nose? Some people get stuck in, you know, how do you clean your nose, Dane? Do you not want to talk about this?
I can talk about it. I don't clean it for food, if that's what you were asking. I'm a tissue guy. Old school tissue guy.
Classic tissue. Handkerchief?
No, I feel like... That's like turning your underwear inside out. It's covered in dirt. So,
yeah.
I'm just basically... do you know what? I actually don't have to clean my nose often these days, you know?
Yeah.
Thankfully, because I just try and live a lifestyle where I got minimal mucus, mate. Minimal mucus.
Yeah. Some people get up to their fucking elbows in it, though, didn't they? They absolutely get...
Listen, I've seen people scratching their hypothalamus.
Yeah.
In their fingers and their nose so far. But I'm an old school tissue guy.
Tissue guy. Nice, tissue guy. Nice. But we ask all of the questions.
All the questions that need to be asked. And if the question is it okay to pick your nose?
Not really.
Especially on public transport. If you knew what your fingers had touched before, I mean, we got to question everything, Howard.
Yeah.
We got to question everything. We have a very esteemed guest on the show today. It's a rising American comedy star currently based in the UK. He has already appeared on numerous one-to-watch lineups and gaining a seriously impressive list of credits. He's become known for his risk-taking, rebellious onstage personality. He has now established himself as a major player on the UK comedy circuit along his stateside work with legendary venues, The Comedy Store and The Laugh Factory. It's the unapologetic, but very friendly and humble, Russell Hicks.
Hey, I make no apologies.
Yeah, there you go.
I've never apologized. I bumped somebody on the tube. Whatever. Look for someone else.
British people love to say sorry all the time as well, Russell. People love to say sorry in this country.
How you been, Russ?
You missing the audiences, Russell, because I know you love to interact with the audiences, right?
So I've done you can do gigs online and stuff, and I figured out how to do that. I just like go through everybody's videos and just make fun of them in person, you know, or over the Skype. It's probably horrifying for them, but yeah, I don't know, man. I'm just kind of missing the I think for a while I wasn't really missing anything. I think what I'm missing now is, like I said, like there's just this invasion of like, I feel like I'm heavily equipped for this because I'm pretty good at just being, like, just hanging out. Like, a lot of people think it's laziness, but I like to think, you know, it's just being, I don't know, at
tranquility.
Peace. Yeah.
Tranquility. You're happy with your own company. You're happy with just, like, the stillness because, you know, the mind remains active. So if you're, you know, it's like a lot of people have to meditate to achieve that state of calm. So if you're just happy, just chilling, like, and especially if you're a cerebral person, it's like, I'm comfortable with my own musings in the world. I'm comfortable with who I am and thinking about it or pondering my existence. That's not a bad thing. That's what you're supposed to do as a comic anyway, is be still and kind of look at the world. So,
well, sometimes I think I'm just too lazy to stress out about stuff, you know, like stressing out about things in the future is just, I'm too lazy for it. Like, that's the thing, man. Everybody panicked the day. I mean, seriously, I couldn't believe how fast people immediately started like doing comedy. Like, I think lockdown was announced on Tuesday. Wednesday morning, I woke up to like everybody was a TikTok star.
Mate, 48 hours it took, and people were like, can you crowdfund me, please? How's the money run out already?
I know. I was like,
2 days.
I was like, can we? I just want to get some food first, if right? That's all right.
Oh, at least, like, I just want to, I don't know, like, tidy my flat first before I start.
Like, I know. It's like, why was that everybody's, like, You know what that reminds me of? I saw there was a plane went down before lockdown, and it didn't. Nobody died, but they had photos in the plane of it going down because some guy had selfied himself. And I thought that was your fucking instinct. That's where you went. He updated his status, Dane, as it was. I'm not even kidding.
What was his emoji? What emoji did he go with?
Yeah, he had, because everybody had the oxygen mask, and he had a photo of himself looking scared, and it said, you know, something like, we hope we make it. I was like, that's what you reached for.
Yeah, he probably should not have made it, to be fair.
So that's what this has reminded me of. Everyone's like, oh my God. And then they just jumped on social media, and it was like, I don't know. So
yeah, interesting times.
And I think in that week, everyone was like, you've got to do this. You've got to do this. And I was just like, whoa.
I never felt like being a member of this, I guess, this cult of comedy was going to exempt me from human tragedy or in any humanitarian crises. I'm sure there were really good Syrian comedians too before the war began. So no one's ever like, can you crowdfund me so that when I get to Kelly, I can still do some gigs? Well, come and see me here, guys. Giving out flyers, like, you know, sometimes flyers.
I just have a hard time with the Kickstarter thing. Like, I haven't done it because it's like, why would I? First of all, I saved, so it's all right. But I was like, why would I expect someone who's struggling to give me some money? I just don't understand.
Yeah.
I mean, unless it's just all celebrities, that's what they should do. We should all the celebrities, first of all, I think should be banned from the internet right now.
Yeah, it is a weird thing, isn't it?
I just feel like we're all trying to go through something and they're just like coming in trying to be like, yeah, me too. And it's like, not now. Like, we only need celebrities when society is at a certain level. We don't need you right now.
Right now, you're of no use to us.
Yeah.
You're not a key worker. And you're not a key worker right now. Even though normally you're perfect for the escapism and distraction that you provide, in this instance, we don't need you right now.
I think all I do now is look at the house behind them. I don't know. I think that's what everyone's like doing that thing where they look at, it's like a portal.
Yeah. Very voyeuristic.
Yeah. Are you watching The Last Dance, that Chicago Bulls
documentary? I've been watching it, and I've been watching it religiously. I absolutely love it.
I love it too. And I just keep looking behind Michael Jordan, like, what is that? It's like, Xanadu.
Where does he live? How does he live?
I know.
People forget that. Like, I think that show, people forget that Jordan as a brand was a part of Nike.
Mm.
And then this became so big, this became its own distinct brand unto itself.
Yeah. It's probably time for a question, isn't it, Dane?
It is time for a question. Russell, thank you so much for coming on the show. As our esteemed guest, we invite you to ask the first question, which we discuss for about 15 minutes. Then Howard will ask a question, and I will finish with a question. We do some blah blahs for the ha ha's. We let everyone know we can find you. We go home. Everybody have a lovely time. Sound like a plan?
I like it. I've got a question.
Go ahead, please.
I think this is pertinent to what we were talking about. I've been thinking about this lately. Now, at the risk of sounding out of touch or old, I just want to know, do you think that the internet is better now, or was it better, not necessarily at its inception, but a previous time, maybe 10 or so years ago? Because I am suspecting that it's changed a lot, and I feel like there was a time when the internet was almost the Wild West, and then now it's become dominated by maybe 5 or 6 corporations. So that's my question to you. Is it better now, or was it better previously?
Russell, what do you remember the internet being like 10 years ago? Are there any particular things that stand out?
So what I was thinking about was, there was obviously, you didn't have a phone. So you would go, you would sit down and engage with it.
Mm.
And you generally had an objective. And you didn't look at other people, because the only thing that families would have websites. Does anyone remember that? Like, Russell, and it was the lamest Russell, shit ever.
I think about this all the time, Russell, because howardcohen.com, which, if I was to show you guys what it is an absolute fucking joke. Where a woman has put up a thing for her grandmother's birthday. Oh, she's finally shut it down. I can get howard.curry.com. But it was literally a picture of her mum's 99th birthday. That was howardcohen.com.
That's what we call a 99th birthday here, Howard. We call it Howard Cohen.
I have something like that. There's this famous movie actor, not even famous. He was in 300 movies as like a tiny part. His name's Russell Hicks. And if you Google me, this motherfucker, man, he always pops up. It looks like I'm dead.
There's a white dude out there performing in the comedy in the UK, and his name was Richard Pryor.
Just change it.
You just gotta change it. Yeah, you gotta change it.
You gotta go under an alias.
Yeah, you gotta change it. It's like there's no more Hitlers now.
Well, they're out there.
The semantics of it is different, but so far as like, you know, filling in an application form, no one's using a real name.
Do you know what? It's interesting you talk about this, Russell, with almost like, you know, think about 10 years ago what the internet was like, because it played a role in my life massively back then. You know, I was making like sketches when I was, you know, quite a junior person in television. And, you know, at the time, it was quite original. I remember telling people, oh, you can watch my sketches online. It was like a few comedy guys that I work with, comedy actors I work with. And, you know, we managed to do some, you know, some quite decent things. Now, again, some of it was shit, but, you know, some of it was good. But there wasn't that much competition, really. We, you know, I didn't know anyone else who was doing it. So it felt like we were original, which I would say is like couldn't be further from the truth right now, right? Like, if you say you've got stuff online, it's just expected of you, isn't it?
Yeah, it's interesting. Like I was, I started comedy right when it all exploded, really. Like I remember it was about 2010 and it was like YouTube had just really taken off, like not even taken off, but it was, I think there was only like, I don't know, like six podcasts or something. It was like a new thing. But even before that, I remember you'd go on the internet and surf the web. Remember? Surf, and you'd go to like random weird shit. It would be like, oh, I'm reading about the war or something. Like, I don't know, but am I delusional? Like, well, because I also remember it was slow.
Yeah,
and you'd a little AOL, man. That was horrible.
But then, before that, if you go to the next generation of kind of technology, before that, it was Encarta. Do you remember Encarta?
I had an Encarta CD.
Encyclopedia.
Was that internet based?
That was internet based. It became internet based, but originally it was the thing that you put in your
CD-ROM. So Encarta was the Wikipedia before Wikipedia. Well, no, Wikipedia is more of a, so people can submit to that, but Encarta was the original encyclopedias. And surfing the web used to be nice. You couldn't do it on your phone. Mm. So I feel like there was a lot more of a concerted effort to spend time paying attention to what you were doing. But the majority of human interaction I saw was in chat rooms. That used to be the big thing, I think.
Oh, yeah, I remember that.
But the thing is, I remember it, but because I was neither a white supremacist or a gay dude or a terrorist, I probably didn't used to use them as often. So but a lot of the time, the irony of the internet nowadays is that the people that we tend to try and censor the most were the people that had the most interaction in chat rooms and in social media years ago.
I know. I was going to say chat rooms was just immediately pedophiles. Like, it feels like pedophiles just jump on every new piece of technology. That's how we catch them.
Well, that's because they have those childlike minds.
Yeah.
Whoever
buys the first 1,000 units of the new iPhone, lock them up.
Oh, definitely. What is the thing as well is that pornography has always been a large driving part in the evolution of the internet anyway. So,
I'm not saying there was. So I would say the disc thing. No, that's too far back. I'm saying there might have been a sweet spot. Maybe it was like 2009 where shit was fast.
The best internet time I've had was maybe 10 years ago when I first discovered Wikipedia. That was probably my best time. Prior to that, I think it was the LimeWire, Kazaa. The torrent era. That was a good time.
This is pre-Instagram, right?
Pre-streaming platform.
Yeah.
You know, in the time where you download from Kazaa or LimeWire and then transfer that onto your Winamp, that was a sweet spot.
I don't know, man. That was pretty stressful. I remember, a lot of work. Because you'd get greedy.
Oh, yeah, you get greedy. I mean, I used to do, but for me, what I would tend to try and do is that I had friends who had like good, strong, maybe ISDN connections or ADSL. They download like torrents for albums, and I just download singles that I like. I mean, God, I remember a time when dudes were burning adult films onto CDs to exchange.
Nice.
I wouldn't say that was a sweet part of the internet.
Yeah.
In fact, that's probably the point in which he started beginning going downhill.
I tell you why it was a sweet era, maybe, Russell, just kind of like trying to hone in on what you're angling at here, is that things felt fresh, right? Things felt original. Like eBay was probably like at that time had kind of had a rise up, and it was just a kind of an amazing thing that you could just, you know, kind of, everything like Amazon, you know, Facebook. I mean, like you say, logging in on your computer to look at Facebook felt like an event, right? Whereas these fucking things in our pockets have just made everything so routine. It's just a routine, right? What you look at.
I mean, if you look at it at all, and it's almost, the problem is that now the internet, and like I said, because there's so much more commercial interest, that's the thing, Howard and Russell, is that it was the monetization of the internet that changed everything. So YouTube, for example, was like the Wild West, and YouTube was like public access.
I think there was such a good time where things felt like they were, like, I suppose MySpace is an interesting thing in this consideration, right? Because that was a part of our lives for a period of time, and then it kind of faded out, and then things have just become so institutionalized, I suppose, is what you're angling at, Russell.
I think, yeah, because I'm always like, it was it though? And I think maybe there was aspects of it that were good back then, but there's a lot of aspects of it now that I definitely appreciate. I mean, like, the stuff that you can access in a way is more vast and much better today.
Yeah.
But I just think that I feel like it's so competitive, and that competition really is not something that, I don't know. I don't, competition causes a lot of discontent in me. Yeah. And I just feel like, I don't know. It's just, and it also seems like there's a lot of, you know, like if you're going to put something on Instagram, there's all these rules to make it successful. And it just really like makes me not want to do it. Cause it's like, let's say I put something on Instagram and everyone's like, well, you got to have subtitles and it's got to have this and it's got to look like that. And it's just like, what a headache, man. Mm-hmm. Like, why can't I, you know what I mean? So I think I'm starting to think maybe there's a way to engage with it today in a way that also utilizes how free it was back then. Whereas I put something on YouTube and this guy was like, your thumbnails are terrible. And I was like,
I had that as well.
And I was just like, you know what? Like, I felt really bad about it. And I got all into it. I was like, well, I got to make good thumbnails. And then I just thought, you know what I'm going to do? I thought it looked cool how it was all different images. And it was just like, I just had black with white writing. And right. I just thought, you don't have to play by these rules. Like, just, I don't really care anymore. I'm like, I'm just going to put something up and forget if it, I don't care if it is fits your little criteria, because it just stops me from wanting to do it. If, you know what I mean?
Yeah.
But that's the commercialization, like Dane was saying. It's because this real estate has been bought by so many people, and it's just like, it's hard to compete. I mean, like, it's like Ellen has an Instagram that's, I mean, there's like an Amazon warehouse working on it. So
you have like click farms. It's like, it's not only, it's fully industrialized in that, like, your presence online is not about you like chatting and wanting to meet people. It's like, now you have to have an established corporate entity whereby, like, there's a artist called Tekashi 6ix9ine who came out of prison, this whole rapper and stuff.
Yeah.
And there's a lot of furore, and it's been the whole controversy about the fact that he came back out after being a police informant, came back, is now free from prison. His contemporaries are now incarcerated for the crimes that they did together. Now he's back. He had like 2 million people watching his Instagram, which is like a record for an Instagram live, to which he's released an album. And he's like, you know, look at my numbers. Like, I can't be ugly. I'm the king of New York. Whereas I think we're now in a state digitally where there is probably a whole nerve center in India of people that are watching his, driving up his numbers, clicking on his things. Like, I think now, where historically you would have had street teams that work to like promote musical artists, there are now people that just employ people to create accounts online. They create accounts online in support of an artist, showing solidarity with them, challenging their detractors to give this false image of popularity for these acts. Like, even the guy, you know, Lil Nas X, who did the song Old Town Road?
Yeah.
That guy used to work for Nicki Minaj as like a fan account.
Oh, I didn't know that.
Wow. Yeah.
Well, that's interesting, because that... this is something that I've thought about where, and this is, I think whenever I talk like this, I sound like old man 90s, where everyone's like, oh, okay, like, go play your hacky sack, grandpa. But it's like, I think that the society has been moving towards being totally corporate for so long. I mean, since, I don't know, the 80s or whatever, and corporations just keep chugging and keep chugging. And they're like the T-1000, man. They just, everything washes off. Like Nike had sweatshops. We all know that. Nike's still around. They just keep going. They're just this thing, right? And so now what's happened is, I feel like individual artists, because of the internet, have somehow become, they're supposed to be not only the creator, but they have to be the marketer, the PR person, and all this, all this business stuff wrapped into one. And I think like that to me is like, if the only people that are going to do well are the people that have those qualities, you're going to lose a lot of really interesting creative people, I think.
Yeah.
Just because, I don't know, maybe that's naive of me to say if you're creative, you're not necessarily business minded, but
it's a saturated space, right? So therefore people will be fighting in a way, and therefore if it wouldn't just be based on talent then, which is what I guess it could have been more based upon in part periods, you know, past, because the kind of the point of entry was quite complicated.
So, well, it's definitely changed the output, because if you think about the qualities of a business versus the qualities of an artist, and I think about this too much, but a business is supposed to give people what they want. The business doesn't think about whether or not it's good for them. McDonald's doesn't go, people like these burgers, but they're not very healthy, so I think we better not.
Exactly.
No, they like just so, but if you look at a good artist, what you make doesn't start from a place of what would people like. You just
no, not at all. Exactly. It's more about how can I take my feelings and then make it in something tangible that other people can perceive, and then they can decide whether or not they like it. But yeah, there's just so many more parties that are involved. And it's the same thing with, you know, it's the transition, I think, Russell, from show to show business, where like now there are more stakeholders involved in what you do. Like with online and performing online, it's like algorithms, and this is supposed to, and we have to now, like you said, you're just trying to put up a funny clip. Someone's talking about your thumbnail. We are like, if picking up an album cover would put you off of an album, then you're just a shallow idiot, really. Like, Dark Side of the Moon by Pink Floyd is like a, what's it, like a prism?
Yeah.
It doesn't show you what the band's about. I can't see what the band is. But so if I'm like, well, this looks like science, no, thank you. Like,
no. Yeah.
And I guess
White album.
I guess exactly, but I guess a part of that is due to the level of saturation and like how it said, how low the barriers are to entry within online fare. Because like I said, it is. I get what you're saying, and I think now is like the Wild West because it's the ease in which other people can enter it. And like I said before, when you had to go on a computer to be interacting on the internet and surfing the web, you needed to make it a concerted effort. Whereas, you know, because you can do it from your phone now, the level of engagement required.
I just think social media in general is weird because predominantly everybody's like, everyone's like, I hate it and it makes me feel bad. And then on the other hand, so like we're told like it's bad for you. And then on the other hand, we're told, but you have to do it. It just seems weird to me, man.
It's because, Russell, that's because the idea of social media is to create the same paradigm of stupidness as high school. Fucking hate high school, but you feel
that's why I don't like it.
Yeah. Fucking hate. Yeah. If you are a critical thinker, you will hate social media because the way people are galvanized and where the association, there's no real merit based on I like this person because they say stuff that I feel empowers me or I identify with psychologically or spiritually. It's just that person's supposed to be popular because they're good looking. So I need to be over here and see what makes them popular. And hopefully by their proxy, I will be popular too, or I can drink off that popularity.
I mean,
in the same way that we all hate it and we just want to, but and we're all like, everyone's like, I hate it. It's terrible. But I want to go. And then it's this whole frenzy of like identity politics and belonging and, you know, comparison, which obviously generates all of the insecurity and hostility on the internet, because you've got a bunch of people who maybe felt like they peaked at high school, who are now living quite menial lives, who can now create a new avatar of themselves as the adolescent they want to be. So it's like, not only can people have to regress back to this high school mentality, but it's now they can create, maybe you can create a personality and a whole persona of yourself that doesn't require, you know, that doesn't require any kind of credibility or any kind of scrutinizing, and just be the person you always wanted to be at high school. And I can go as far as to be like, I wish I was a woman in high school. And then all of a sudden you can just transition on the internet.
Yeah.
I mean, it's that straightforward. And, you know, that level of escapism, unfortunately, people really, really thrive off that in like I said, in a world of supply and demand. Like, that's not even the world we live in economically anymore. The demand is supplied by corporations. And then if you don't get involved, then you're made to feel ashamed.
Well, and it's like the biggest experiment that's never been given restrictions ever, social media, right? Like, it is never been tested as to what the impact will be on a large group of people. We're just finding out week by week, year by year, what it's doing to us. And clearly there's some negative repercussions.
I did like Kimbo Slice, though, having bum fights. That was pretty cool. Remember that?
Oh, yeah. R.I.P. Rips.
Kimbo. You ever see Rotten.com?
Oh, yeah.
And then I stopped liking the internet for a while.
Wait, did I see Rotten.com? I don't know. What is that?
It was just a basically a website where all the stuff that you now see, which is like not safe for work.
Yeah.
Like, pictures of like autopsies and plane crashes.
Oh, yeah.
And,
oh, God. Oh, I heard about that. Yeah.
Cartel executions. But then that being said, I actually think, what the hell's wrong? But then there used to be a tape and they just show just all this violent stuff and Mexican cartel stuff just filmed.
Mm. Wow. Damn, dude. I didn't roll with those circles.
No, I didn't see it, but I heard of it. It's like, you know.
Yeah, yeah.
It's like the Animal Farm tape. Like, you hear about it, but I don't want to see it.
Yeah. It's a bloody good question, Russell. I imagine we could talk about that all day because the internet just has taken over so much of our lives, isn't it?
It's so interesting as well to be at a stage in our lives socially where we're like, it wasn't like my internet. You know, in my day, you had your mouse and people would listen.
I know. That's what I'm afraid of sounding like. Because I do love everything. There's so much I love today. I just think as far as my diet is concerned, I don't have a lot of time for just kind of like, I mean, like The Last Dance is like, what? It's going to be like 30 episodes.
Yeah.
No, I think it's over soon.
Is it? I can't be watching that. And also, I don't know, whatever your family vacation photos are on Instagram.
Yeah. Well, this is how people consume. People are overstimulated. And yeah, it's very hard for anyone to process any clear thoughts if they're doing all of that. But just who we are now.
But with that said, follow me on Instagram. It's Russell Hicks. Because I'm gonna try. I'm gonna just use it how I want to use it. You know what I mean?
Of course.
The institutions use. Make you use it. Don't make it use you.
I'm gonna move this conversation into a very different area for my question, if that's cool with you, Russell. And my question was gonna be a simple one. Do you like guns? Because I can't help but feel that the approach that people are having at the moment in this apocalypse is obviously what happened in Michigan with the protests quite early on during the kind of COVID outbreak, where they stormed the government house and didn't look like they were going to use the guns, and then they just had these fucking massive rifles as they stormed it. How do you feel about guns, Russell, as a former American citizen?
It's weird, my relationship with guns, because I like movie guns.
Right.
Like, I love a movie with guns just all over the place.
Yeah.
Irresponsible bullets flying at random.
End of Scarface, right?
Oh, end of Scarface. Yes. Grenade launchers. I think you're bullish, man. but that is not real guns. Like, I remember my neighbor had two rifles and they were just like in his house. And I remember just like seeing him. But when I was in America, I was a kid. It was his dad. And I just remember they just terrified me. And I was like, why would you want to have those in your... I don't understand how it makes you feel safe. My attitude with guns was always like, if there's no gun in the house, the chances of being shot by one are zero. As soon as you put a gun in the house, no matter how responsible you are, the statistics have risen by about 10, like now there is a gun present. So this idea that like more guns in America doesn't cause people to get shot is like completely stupid.
It couldn't be more stupid, could it really?
Yeah, because it's like, what are the odds you're going to get stabbed by a knife in this house? Well, there's no knives in the house. Well, then it's impossible. Well, I've just added one knife. Well, even if I'm living with monks, it's still 0.1% because there's a knife. So I think America's relationship with guns is really just the fact that they don't like to be told what to do. And they also like and this is also what I love about America, actually, is that we love and pride ourselves on being completely opposite from the rest of the world.
Right.
So if you really want America to get rid of guns, Canada, Canada just has to pretend to love them. And we'll be like, fuck those French. Like, we'll just be done. If Britain just pretends they like love weapons, America will be like, nope.
I don't think Britain's got to do it. I think it's got to be another country. Well, a country that America can't really invade that easily. And then if they show that they like guns, then America will be less adverse to it.
Yeah, the French.
Yeah. The French.
But I've never shot one. I mean, I imagine they're fun. Like, if you're in a shooting range, it's probably fun to shoot it.
Did you have them as a kid, as in like toy guns when you were growing up? Like, was that a part of your childhood?
Yeah, I mean, I never was into. I always thought that I had like super soakers.
Yeah, which is a form of gun.
Which is cool because you get
a water gun. You know.
Yeah, you get to do the like.
Yeah.
But I always found the plastic guns you could get that were like exact replicas of like a black AK-47. I just thought those were like boring and weird.
It's weird, isn't it? Because you know, I don't know where you know, when you were a kid, if you went to like a fun fair or like a fairground, you know, and there'd be the things where you shoot, you know, like the targets and you win a prize, and you know, that's kind of like quite a nice use of guns, right? Like,
yeah.
Target practice. Like, that's not such a terrible idea, is it? But how that kind of develops, I think, as you get a bit old. So it's just the idea of wandering around your garden with fake guns as a kid was probably quite normal many years ago. And now just seems absolutely mental, isn't it?
It's normal. It'll be normal if you're white, because like for most American celebrities I see in America, this is there's always that picture of them with so it's always a picture with the pistols dressed up as a cowboy.
Mm. Mm.
That's a natural part of the culture, which I thought was natural until Tamir Rice was 12 when he was murdered by the police and nobody went to prison for that, for having a toy gun, like a cap gun. So what I thought was always a natural image or icon of Americana very soon became very weird and dark. So when you say Americans love guns, I feel like some Americans love guns, but they're just more depending on whose hands those guns are in.
Mm.
Probably... the point I was leaning towards there, because, you know.
Ryan Reynolds here from Mint Mobile. With the price of just about everything going up during inflation, we thought we'd bring our prices down. So to help us, we brought in a reverse auctioneer, which is apparently a thing.
Mint Mobile Unlimited Premium Wireless. How to get 30, 30, how to get 30, how to get 20, 20, 20, how to get 20, 20, how to get 15, 15, 15, 15, just $15 a month? Sold!
Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month. Slows full terms at mintmobile.com.
I'm Sandra, and I'm just the professional your small business was looking for. But you didn't hire me, because you didn't use LinkedIn Jobs. LinkedIn has professionals you can't find anywhere else, including those who aren't actively looking for a new job, but might be open to the perfect role, like me.
In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't visit other leading job sites. So if you're not looking on LinkedIn, you'll miss out on great candidates, like Sandra. Start hiring professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/people today.
I think guns are very much glamorized as we're all growing up, and they've always been an indicator of like power and obviously a tool of most stories that we tell involving like, you know, struggles of good against evil. And you're normally your lead protagonist in most of the media that we've been brought up on will have the biggest guns. And there's even like a real phallic symbolism to having guns as well. But I just think that as much as we create this idea that Americans love guns, I think it's more of a function of Americans love a certain lifestyle and privilege and are prepared to use guns to defend that.
Hmm.
So I don't know if I've skewed the question.
I don't know, because like I think where I grew up in America on the West Coast, you didn't run into that many like gun-toting enthusiasts. It wasn't really a thing, but like there's certain parts of America where guns are part of the culture. Mm-hmm. And so for some reason, Americans can't like, they see it as a threat. I think it's less that they're like, I like these guns and I have all these reasons to have these guns, than they just don't like to be told we're going to take something from you.
Mm.
And they just see it as like, everything's a slippery slope in the United States. It's really weird.
Yeah.
Like everything is like, well, if we do that, then eventually like we'll just, you know, we'll become this like socialist society or whatever. It's bizarre, man.
Yeah. From a young age, I always felt like you were kind of presented with, like you say, a super soaker is kind of, or like Nerf guns have been like massively popular for years and years, right? Like those things that shoot.
Yeah. Both invented by the same guy, Lonnie Johnson.
Really? Interesting.
Yeah.
Well, but the Nerf gun I liked.
The Nerf gun and the super soaker were both created by the same guy.
That's
and,
mad that you know that.
Yeah, because it's the only guns that a black man's ever invented. And he didn't get paid for them until 2016.
Wow.
So he wasn't even paid out on a patent for those weapons until 2016.
Oh, damn.
Yeah. That's why I know that, Des.
Those are sick. I love the super soaker. I did like, I had a Nerf gun that shot like Nerf stuff, like darts and stuff.
Yeah.
Like Nerf darts. But,
but it's weird. It's weird to think, right, that you know, as much as all three of us here are non-gun-toting, violent people, you are given a kind of upbringing. And then culturally, like you said, in movies, right? Like, I mean, if you get a good gun-toting, like I watched Heat a couple of weeks ago, you know, the Michael, some of the gun scenes in that when they're robbing banks is just fantastic. So you can't really deny, I think, that you actually do quite like guns in some ways.
Yeah.
Just you don't want to have a load of them in your house.
Well, that's what I'm saying. I love movie guns. I love guns in movies.
Movie guns are great. Everyone loves a movie gun.
And they always blame... I remember when like some shootings happened in America and they blamed Quentin Tarantino. And I was like, well, if every Tarantino fan shot up a place, you'd see a lot more style. Like it's not
exactly,
you know what I mean? If the guy showed up wearing a Hawaiian t-shirt and recited a passage from the Bible, I'd be like, yeah, probably. But no, they're always dorks. They're always just these like nerds that were into like army figures and stuff.
They're always into the army. Most, like 9 out of 10 school shooters or people involved in massacres have all served in the armed forces of one form or another.
Yeah.
So, now, this could be my internet shit right now, Russell, but you go back and look at those guys and look at all of their haircuts and see what they have in common.
Really?
Dylan Roof, the guy who shot up who Charlottesville, and the same guy who did the shooting for the in the cinema, and all I do that shot up the Amish. Who is shooting up the Amish? Like, they can't defend themselves. It's nothing worse than that. So,
yeah.
But these guys all have a very similar haircut. And again, it's like, it's so weird that they always have this weird military background.
Well, another thing about I think the biggest reason for all the shootings in America was, and nobody seemed to ever talk about this, but I was like, if you stop doing this, you'll stop having them. They would turn them into celebrities. So
yeah,
it was
definitely.
Yeah. So it was a way for these people to be like, I'm a loser. I'm never going to be anything. And right now, celebrity is such a massive desire for everyone.
It is, and attention is the most powerful currency on this planet right now.
So they'd be like, well, if I shoot this place up, then they'll talk about me for a week, and they'll want to know what was. So if they just would not give their photo and talk to their parents or something,
yeah.
But there's guns in the UK, right? I've seen them at toy shops and stuff.
There's loads of guns in the UK. I was never allowed to toy gun when I was a kid.
Why is that?
Why was I not allowed to toy gun?
Mm.
Oh, just literally because it represents, and my parents didn't want me to have a natural propensity towards using guns or violence. I guess because they're aware that, like, you know, we are very desensitized to violence in this country.
Yeah, so, I wasn't really allowed to have one either, BB gun or anything.
Yeah.
Yeah.
I fired guns before, but, like, yeah, never had a gun. And, yeah, I've seen loads of guns, but
it's just weird to think how normalised they actually are. So if you take it away from the mass shooter or the person,
I mean, they've been pretty normalised for a long time. I think the weird thing for me was that, like, you know, guns and the black community, the real profile of it came along with Operation Trident.
Right.
So I think that was like 1996. The police started Operation Trident, which was their scheme for them to monitor the movement and use of guns within the black community. Mm. Which I found was very strange because it came immediately a year after the Mephiston inquiry revealed institutional racism in the police. It wasn't really the real campaign to go with. But I find it also very weird that you were profiling black communities when handguns became illegal in the UK because of the Dunblane massacre.
Mm.
That's why handguns became illegal, because prior to that, handguns were legal in the UK. And what used to happen is a very frequent process of converting of air rifles to fire live ammunition.
Right.
So there's like one gun called the Brockhawk, it was a 22 revolver, and people would convert that into an actual pistol as well. It was like an air pistol. And I had a friend, he had like a, I think I had a, one of the friends I went to, he had a, yeah, a Smith & Wesson, like a 9mm, but I used to fire like steel ball bearings.
Wow. Hmm.
And where I used to live as well, there was a place called Catford Gun Company, which would sell rifles and like shotguns for like shooting pheasant and clay pigeons and stuff. But downstairs, they had fully automatic weapons and they had like a soundproof like shooting range.
Hmm.
So, yeah.
That sounds kind of cool.
Oh, it's cool as hell. It's amazingly cool. Oh, no one's disputing it's not
shooting
cool.
Shooting range beneath your house.
It's so weird. We like guns, right?
And soundproof underground.
I would shoot guns with Dane.
Yeah, I mean, we built fun guns. The mentality behind the barrel is very important as well. But yeah, it was fun, but it was like, and then you have to consider that the 90s also had like the Yugoslavian war. So you had all these countries breaking off and being armed and then having those. And then at the end of that, all the guns that would have been decommissioned, what happened to the flow of those? Then you had the troubles in terms of Northern Ireland and the Republic.
Hmm.
So, you know, guns and armaments have kind of been flown quite freely through the UK for a while. So it's always weird that there's a supposition that we're not really okay with guns. I think because of there's a lot of gun amnesties and a lot of handgun bannings, it means a lot of the guns in circulation in the UK aren't particularly, they're not new guns.
No.
Yeah.
There's a lot of old guns in the UK. So we don't really, so in terms of internal exporting of guns, we don't really get a lot, but. Yeah, we fine with guns here.
Yeah. You just looked at us like, but if you want to get them, Dane knows what you're I'm your man.
Well, you can't just bat him on the shot, but if you... I'm sure that's with anybody if you want a gun bad enough. I had a friend that moved into a house and so he found a gun in his attic.
Wow.
Whoa.
That's crazy.
Hitting it there.
So, that's different to a spare light bulb, isn't it? Bloody hell.
Absolutely. Although, still lights out. Pow!
That was my question, guys. I wanted to pick your brains about that. I think it's a really weird subject.
It was a good question.
It was a good question.
It wasn't at all jingoistic. That's why we ended it on Britain's got shitloads of guns too. So.
Dane, let's chuck it over to you for your question and the final question of today's show.
Again, Russell, has been an absolute pleasure. What our listeners may not know is that Russell is very unique in that he may be one of the only comics. There's very few comics who never do the same set twice and are able to completely improvise on stage. So I'm in awe of this gift that you have. And I want to know if you've ever written down a set or if you ever wrote down your first. What I want to know is, because I know you don't write down sets really, what was your, do you remember your first ever comedy set?
Yeah. Yeah, because I used to write, when I first started, I would write it all down. Like I would do bullet points because I didn't really know that you could do that, which I kind of like that because it's not like I went into the game like, oh, I know you can just riff. I didn't really realize that till like 2 years later, a year after. But I would, I remember I left my notebook. I lost it, my first notebook. And then about 5 years ago, I went back to America and I was at some bar. And they were all looking at this. They had this like notebook and they were all laughing at it. I was like, what's that? And they're like, oh, I don't know. We've always had this notebook here. And we all just pull it out sometimes and look at the words. And it was mine.
That's fucking crazy. That's crazy.
I was like, that's my notebook. And they're like, oh my God, this has been sitting behind the bar for like 6-7 years. I was like, and so I got my first notebook and I still have the only notebook from that time I have. And they were laughing at it because the idea is it just said like, there was just stuff that just said like big penis. I was like, all right. And that was like,
affirmations.
Yeah. But it was circled with stars on it. So that was like my killer, whatever, my big penis bit.
Do you remember how that first gig went, Russell? How was that first gig?
Actually, my very first gig was, I remember this really well. I had just dropped my then like partner off at the airport. And I was like, I'm going to go do this, my first set tonight. Okay. And I go down there and I called my brother and I was like, hey, come with me. And on the whole way down there, I was listening to this comedian, Stephen Wright, who does like one-liners and stuff. And I just started thinking of all these jokes I was going to do. But I had just had this experience at the airport, which the airport at the time, this is like the Bush era. It was really just driving me insane. Or no, it wasn't. It was the Obama, but it was still the TSA and all that shit. And like, so I get there and I go to my brother I was like, all right, I'm going to do this open mic. It was a musician open mic, and they were like, we don't like comedians. And so there was like, there was only like six people in the crowd, and all these musicians wanted to play. And I was like, this is like Roadhouse. This is going to be terrible. And so tell my brother, I go, let me just tell you my set. Okay. So I do this 5 minutes and I tell him these jokes. I still remember one of the jokes. It was so bad. I've been listening to Stephen Wright. It said, my car says, the dashboard said low oil. Does that mean my car is depressed and it wants me to massage it? Okay. And my brother, after I'm done with the set, my brother goes, everything you just said is the worst shit I've ever heard in my life. And I was like, and then that made me a little bit mad. And I started yelling at him I was like, well, what do you want from me? And I started saying, I've been at the airport all day. And I just went off on one about the TSA and then the airport. And he was like, say all that. He was laughing. He was like, dude, say all that. And I was like, oh shit. And then, so we like wrote down all this like stuff that I just said. And I went on stage and it was like, that was it. I just talked about, I remember doing it. I just went on stage. I did a bit that I just thought about. It was about the TSA, about how the same person that is checking my bag for bombs, you know, is like the same person who can't find a pube in my Big Mac or something like that, whatever. Like, yeah. And
I like that.
And it was like, I just did that. And then I just remember it went by in a blindingly. And then I prepared too much from then on, like 6 months of that. But it was interesting that the first time I did good was because I kind of like did what I do now, which is like, oh, I've just thought of this. Maybe I'll say it. It was very capricious, very like fucking whatever. But yeah, cool, I used to just always do new shit. I experimented a lot, man. I did like characters. I remember there was this one bar that was really rough to play. And so I bombed there. And then what I did to get revenge on them was I came back and did this character where I filled this prescription pill bottle with Tic Tacs. And I just pretended I was really nervous. And I just kept taking Tic Tacs, but they thought they were pills. And then I eventually dumped all of them in my mouth and they were just piling out of my mouth. And I ran out the door, jumped in my car and drove away. And I never went back to the gig.
How did the gig go?
I called my friends. The next day, everyone was like, dude, everyone just stood there like for like 10 minutes. Like they didn't know what happened. The mic was just on the floor. I don't know, man. I still
I like it. Sometimes you got to hold that audience hostage and let them know, man, you're performing. It's all good. I do want to say though, your brother don't know what the fuck he's talking about. I don't care. He weren't there on stage with you. I'm projecting. Cause you know, with family, it doesn't matter how good you get. Like they'll be like, I think you could be doing this a bit more.
Yeah, but he was totally correct. Yeah. He's never criticized me since. He's like a huge supporter, but he genuinely probably saved me in that moment from a year of being terrible.
You know, it's interesting because with me, my first set, I remember the first couple, two or three drafts did the same. Just I didn't even get them on stage, but I was reading them back and I'm like, this is not funny. And it was when I was trying to write jokes and trying to write funny stuff. And it was only when I started writing what I felt to be true and to be esoteric truths. And I was like, this makes sense to me. I can say this on stage and I can say this in earnest. And, you know, and that's when one of the first lessons you learn. It's all in the delivery. And there's tragedy plus timing. But for me, it was like, I had the same process of trying to write something that made people laugh. And it was like...
Yeah. Well, then after a while, I realized I was like, oh, yeah. I was like, if I thought about my whole life, I was like, nobody's ever said like, oh, Russell tells this great story. Oh, you've got to hear. It was always just sitting in an office and being the worst employee in the history of employment and just making my friend next to me laugh about random bullshit. You know what I mean? Just improvising.
But that improvising element is fascinating to a lot of, because I don't think everyone who watches stand up or sees live comedy truly understands the impact that improvising and crowd work has. Because obviously everyone generally in live comedy writes something or has an idea of what they're going to do. But the percentage with which you can play with the audience that night you're there makes such a difference, doesn't it? It's the current, as big a currency as writing at times for people, isn't it?
Absolutely. I agree. I think so. I think it's a different skill from writing and performing jokes, but it requires the same amount of work and a knowledge of timing and being able to have an energy exchange and read a room and Yeah.
Well, it's the bit that's the one-off, right? Like, so, you know, Russell, if people go and check out Russell online, they'll see on his YouTube channel and other places, you get into things with people in the crowd. I know Dane does as well, and many comedians do, but there was a couple of clips I saw of you, Russell, getting into an argument with an American guy at Top Secret Comedy Club or like... Like, and those moments are the most alive, I think, that people ever feel in most performance spaces across any genre, really. Like, you might see a guy do a guitar solo and he changed the guitar solo a bit or the lyrics change, but that one moment where this person fucks you off or you just end up going down a road with them is worth so much to the audience and the performers, I think, in terms of getting that flow of laughter going, right?
That was one thing I was always able to do, even in my life, is I will service the laugh to my own detriment. Even like if I think I can get a laugh here, and this is like when I had jobs and everything, I'll just like tunnel vision that Kill Bill music. It's like, like if I'm on stage, I'll be like, I'm taking this as far as we can go, you know, past that sort of point of like, oh, cause you cannot back down from any situation. You can't sort of like creep back out the door on stage, like you're dead. So you've just got to kind of like, I don't know. I'm always interested in that. Like if someone's arguing with me or something funny's happening, I'll be like, let's just take this thing all the way to the edge. I don't know what,
I think
listen, I don't know if they told you, but I don't apologize. And I'm rebellious. So,
but the thing that fascinates me is obviously there's people who haven't got that in them, right? Like, and it doesn't mean that they can't write a really good joke. That's clearly that is a clear thing. You can not be able to interact with punters and an audience and still write good jokes. But when you see those moments happen, I mean, it must make you feel more alive than anything, though, right? When it's going well and suddenly out of nothing, literally just out of the scenario that has presented itself tonight, given the people that have turned up to the gig, we're given the chance to just freestyle.
Yeah, I think that's the thing about being like, when you figure out what you want to do on stage, it's almost like comedians, I think, are genuinely like messed up and we don't really fit in society. But ironically, all of those things on stage will work for you. Like, for example, I have an addictive personality. I like, you know, so like probably I shouldn't drink or something like that. But on stage, that charge that I get out of improvising is I like that buzz. And so I harness that addiction. And then, so there you go. So actually having an addictive personality and having ADD and being all those things, it works if you know how to, you know, ride it in stand-up, I think. I don't know. Right? Like, Dane, you're, I don't know, what would you say Dane, you probably are a super deep thinker, right?
I mean, I have no frame of reference, but for me, it's I wouldn't say it's deep. It's more about having unfettered thinking. So it's like, if I think about something, I don't think about it by like, so if I'm considering gender politics, I'm not like, oh, what does it mean for women to have feminism for me as a man? It's like, I don't try and think about the politics of life with identity politics. I'm not thinking about stuff as like how it affects me as a man or as it affects me as a black man. It's just always trying to look at everything externally. And with common sense, right? It's like, for example, I'll talk about something like even in social media, I'll be like, look, I don't understand why we celebrate Halloween, because Halloween used to be a celebration of like the occult, right? People dressed up as witches and like wizards and ghouls and stuff, right? Now, like girls are wearing like jean shorts with the butt cut out to look like Harley Quinn, but this has nothing to do with Halloween. So really, Halloween is nothing but a celebration of how subjected we are to Hollywood marketing and merchandising. And then everyone, I just say to people, why do you celebrate them? Because it's nothing to do with if you dress up Captain America, cool, but it's not Halloween. If you're dressing up in like lingerie, like if you dress up in lingerie and just because you've got like contact lenses in, it's like, this is not a critique of how you dress, but it's like, that's Valentine's Day. That's not Halloween.
Right. Yeah. I was just thinking of corporations sending out like, yo, what are you? Oh, I'm Amazon.com.
It's not that far off. So yeah, for me, I try not to say I'm a deep thinker, but it's always just a thing of, I'm always just trying to encourage people to consider something without thinking about it in terms of like being an employee. It's like, if you got somebody by themselves in like a room where they knew that they wouldn't be heard or wouldn't be any repercussions, or I'm not trying to use this as a measure of your intellect. I think what most people will tell you about themselves will be very different to what they would normally say when they're more considering social convention and etiquette. Like, most people will be like, well, my job's going very well, and in 5 years' time, I see myself, you know, really becoming a marketing, the head of marketing as an executive. But really, the truth is, you never wanted to fucking do that as a child. That never even entered your head. And if you had the chance where money wasn't an object, you probably wouldn't be doing it. And I'm just trying
to... Right. So that's what I was trying to get at, is like, your superpower on stage would not be something that would service you in society, because I'm imagining you work at an ice cream shop and I'm like, how's the rocky road? You'd be like, it's fucking garbage.
Yeah,
like,
exactly.
And your boss would be like, Dane, we're really trying to push
it. And that's the problem. That was always my approach. Like, I remember I used to work in media sales, and I remember my manager, my last manager before I decided to do comedy as well. She was like, said this, keep it in mind, the manager of a sales team. And, she felt I was being too cocky. Lord knows why, because it wasn't like I was making loads of money. But she was like, I don't know why you get so up your own arse, Dane. It's like 80% of most sales are luck anyway. And again, I was like, even if you don't like me, is that the best way to motivate a sales executive?
Yeah.
Because at the same time, because then she'd have like, we'd have like a sales pipeline, and they'd be like, these are all your sales that's going to like 75% likely to come in. And these are the ones that you're 50-50 about. And I'm like, but if 80% of these are all luck, why do I have this spreadsheet?
Yeah.
It doesn't make sense. And I keep saying to people, if it's luck, why have you got a spreadsheet? And everyone would just be like, please, I'm just trying to earn money for my family. You see the picture of them on my screensaver. That's why I'm here.
Yeah, yeah. I know. That's the thing. That's that mindset of breaking everything. Everything is ridiculous. Yeah. I think that's another thing about a stand-up. When a stand-up is... I don't know, a comic in general, just in life, you're like, everything, you have to bring everything back to like...
Yeah, nothing can be taken seriously. Yeah, you can't take anything seriously, including yourself, especially yourself.
Yeah, but if there's anything in the air that's not being acknowledged, we have to acknowledge it, otherwise it drives us nuts.
Exactly.
Like, yeah, jobs were the worst, yeah. Like,
yeah, jobs, yeah, exactly. And for me, it's like, you know, again, I always reinforce the point to people where I'm like, I don't know how much of an intrinsic reward there is with hitting a sales target, because it's like, if I get a black belt, I've completed a stage of a martial arts system, and I can go and do a new martial art because I've got a certain level of proficiency here, or I continue to learn, right? Because you can build on it, and you gain more proficiency or whatever. Or like, for example, if you follow a recipe and you make a cake, there's a visual representation of your achievement that can be enjoyed. If you hit a sales target, you're just going to have to hit another sales target and a higher one.
Yes, that's what I mean. I remember when I worked at jobs and they would do all that like, we're a family and all this motivation stuff. And like, so the comedian is like, "What? Why are you like, I can't buy into this. Just tell me, look me in the eye and tell me that I am just a number. And if I don't
perform, at least be honest. At least be honest. If you give this impression that we're a family, it's like when people are like, they need to apply yourself and you can go somewhere. I'm like, but I'm looking in your open plan office and there's a woman having a nervous breakdown. So like, and it's so bad as well. What makes it even worse was that I won't take it seriously and I'll question stuff. And then, you know, people are not used to stuff being questioned. Because I remember, like, I'd question one of my managers in my first sales job. And she'd be just on me the whole time. You're shit. You're not at uni anymore. Like, there's this whole thing that people have with me with reminding me that even though I have a degree, they're my boss.
Yeah. Where did you work, dude? Wall Street?
No, I didn't. I worked in Hammersmith at a sales company that sells, like, magazines for, like, regeneration and renewal. Like, real boring business publications. But then, like, it'd be, for example, they'd be like, Dane, we want you to go to call people in Scotland and pitch this magazine because if the legislation is changing, they're going to need jobs. And I'd be like, but if they don't have that legislation in Scotland, why do I have Scotland? And they'd be like, why are you so rebellious? You're always answering back. And I was always under this impression that I was the weakest link and I was the person that needed to catch up with everyone in my sales team. Yeah. What I didn't know is that everyone else is having, like, they're crying their eyes out on the corridor because they can't take the pressure. I didn't know you're supposed to crack under pressure at work. I didn't, because they're like, you know, be a salesperson, be tenacious. But everyone else on my team's had a fucking nervous breakdown. Then they come back and they all sit there being quiet while I'm getting fucking blazed and roasted. These times they've all had their own mental health breakdowns.
I don't know how people stay in jobs like that. Like,
I have no idea.
Honestly, man.
And trust me, to any listeners here, quitting is much easier than you think it is. It's so easy.
Yeah, I was at a telemarketing place once and this guy is screaming Yeah. I had an employee in the office, and this was my first day. I hadn't even clocked in yet. And I'm just watching that, looking around like, we're not getting paid enough for this. And I just told the guy, I go, I left my pen in my car.
Yeah.
And he stared at me and he goes,
that's the worst excuse I've ever.
I know. And he goes, did you really? And I go, yeah. And he goes, you're coming back, right? I was like, yeah. And it was an open window and he could see me go out, get in my car and drive away. I was like, peace. Who the fuck would stay in that job? I was like, we're not getting any money. I'm going to be yelled at.
Yeah.
By somebody who odds are not even in full control of their own lives to be telling you how to live yours. Like, and that's what I mean. Like that for me, I don't think I have any unique or superior insight to most people. It's just that I just don't let the voices that go, you need a job to be able to get a pension and you need a job for your family, blah, blah, blah. Those things just don't enter my head.
Like, can I ask one last question just for Dane? This is a quick one because Dane, you're like a Nostradamus to me. I think you're very wise. What? Where are we going?
Nostradamus. Sorry, just throwing that out there.
Nice.
Where are we going after this, Dane? Where is comedy headed after the outbreak? Are we?
Comedy is definitely, the numbers are going to be thinned out significantly. I think we probably at best have maybe another year and a half before we reach some point of normalcy, unless there's more novel ways for you to interact with the audience, or you can literally have a space where you can have social distancing, then it might take a while. And there may be some politics about it. It's just going to be a very painful, awkward experience of listening to people say stuff like, well, I had a wife before Corona. Give it to me so I can kill myself and not listen to this anymore. I look at a point in time where, you know, someone who looked like me wasn't even allowed on television. So people have endured and they've been able to prosper throughout worse for myself. So that's why I'm like, it could be worse. Yeah. When the war starts running and the lights go out, then I'll be worried.
Yeah, but Dan, you have to understand, as a white man, this is the hardest I've ever had it. So good for you, but I'm really struggling.
We're here for you, Russell. We're here for you, Russell. And thank you for coming on the show.
We're here for you. That's it. Thanks. We're here for you. You're going to get through this, man.
Yeah. Thanks for having me, man.
No, I hope you've enjoyed it. It's been amazing talking to you.
It's been great, man. Russell, please tell the audience where they can find the stuff and check it out. I can't recommend Russell enough. He was my amazing tour support before we postponed the tour for next year. So I definitely can't recommend this guy enough. I vouch for this man. Where can we find you, Russell?
Thank you, buddy. I have stuff that I have vast archives of all this, like, because I do, like you said, improvise so much. I'm just putting stuff on YouTube from plumbing the archives. I've got tons and tons of stuff. So if you want to see what it is I do, that's where you can go. And also, yeah, I'm doing Instagram. Why do I sound like such an old man when I say it? Can I just say
I'm uploading to Instagram?
I'm doing Instagram.
Surfing the gram. Russ, love the new hair, bro. Stay strong. And
thanks.
Yeah, let's talk again soon, bro. Good to hear from you.
Take care of yourself, man. Russell. Thanks. Look after yourself. Have a good day, man. You've been listening to Dane Baptiste Questions Everything, hosted by Dane Baptiste. For more from Dane, go to danebaptiste.co.uk or follow him on Twitter at DaneBapTweets or Instagram at DaneSnapTeast. Our guest was Russell Hicks. You can follow Russell on Twitter and Instagram at Russell Hicks with two S's. The show is produced by me, Howard Cohen. Follow me on Twitter and Instagram at The Howard Cohen. The show is mixed and mastered by Decode. You can follow D on Twitter and Instagram at OfficialDecode. Please rate and review the show on Apple Podcasts or wherever you listen to us. You can find us on Twitter and Instagram at DBQE Podcast. Thanks to Polly, Gelly and the Acast team for all their support. Thanks for listening, guys. And remember, question everything.
Tired of ads intruding into your favorite comedy podcasts? Good news! Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Dive into a world of laughs by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/comedyadfree. That's amazon.com/comedyadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.